Brooklyn.
Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
What would save the world?
Veganism.
Gun control.
Ending capitalism.
Consensus.
More guns.
Nonviolent communication.
Anarchy.
Green energy.
Spirituality.
More regulation.
Emotional education.
End the war on drugs.
Libertarianism.
Socialism.
I'm Tuke Edelo, and this is
What Would Save the World on Radio Free Brooklyn every Wednesday from 3 to 4 p.m.
Some days, everybody, I wake up in the morning and I think to myself, am I the angriest Jew in the world? I think the answer is probably yes. But here's the thing. Like, everybody always wants to be like, Tuke, why are you so angry? Why are you so negative? And I'm like, a lot of shit to be angry about, but I'm not fucking negative. I'm super fucking positive. I'm way more positive than you because I see possibilities and I will not accept the idea that things cannot be changed as they are. That's you. You're the negative one. You're the stagnant fucking little bitch. All right. But bitch stands for babe in total control of herself because I believe in your autonomy. But you're still fuck you and your negativity. Don't fucking call me negative. That's negative. God, I sound like I'm victim blaming right now. I'm sorry you had to fucking deal with my fucking negativity. But apparently my show, one of my friends said it just sounds like fuck every other sentence. Well, it fucking does. Because I can say fuck on this radio show. But yeah, when I say the angriest Jew in the world. So basically, like, there's this fucking Hanukkah gingerbread house. And like, if I couldn't spell assimilation before, now I can. Because it's just like, how the fuck, Hanukkah, nobody would give a fuck about Hanukkah if it wasn't for Christmas being in the wintertime. Because, I mean, Hanukkah's not even that big of a holiday, honestly. Like, I'm sure some Jews would argue it because, you know, people want to be assimilated, I guess. I guess just like a lot of Jews forgot that at some point we weren't white, but they still want to claim not whiteness. Like, it's this fucking weird thing. Like, Irish people and everybody who, like, at some point wasn't classically white has to just, like, look in their history and remember what it meant to not be white. Or they wouldn't fucking give a shit about... am I making sense? Here, let's get my guest on here. Because I just fell off my rant a little bit. We're here with Sergio Castillo. He's an amazing playwright. Wrote a play called Radical, and we're going to talk a little bit about it. Do I sound crazy when I'm talking about whiteness here, or do I make sense?
Well, it's under the assumption that whiteness... isn't static. I mean, whiteness, the definition of whiteness is constantly changing in America. Like you said, Italians and Jews and Irish were not considered white when they came here. And so if we're honestly going to be talking about some sort of revolutionary cause in the future where we're having racial liberation, we have to have a serious conversation about what whiteness is and how people define whiteness in America and what those privileges actually mean.
Yeah, I feel like that. You can lower the mic on yourself. Yeah, you can. Okay, yeah. Live radio, everybody. But it's just like, I just feel like that's a thing when I talk to Jews. Like, they're so, like, into this idea that they're not actually white because they want to have Israel. But I get it. Like, it is complicated. Like, I guess, like, we're all kind of from the Middle East somewhere in there. But we are white. We benefit from white privilege. There are actually not white Jews. That's important to clarify. But, like, a lot of, like, white Jews, like... It's a very weird thing where they don't want to be called white, but they want to be white because they want to be assimilated into, like, this the idea of this consumerist winter solstice time.
Well, if you consider Israel as something of a European colony, because, I mean, we talk about, like, Ethiopian Jews, you know, in Israel who suffer the same kind of discrimination as Somalian immigrants. I mean, there is, like, almost this need, I think, for a lot of... disenfranchised or marginalized groups in the past to try and to assimilate to whiteness so they're not considered a minority and so that they receive the privileges of whiteness. I think about this in the Latino community a lot, where we have, you know, white Latinos who are so strongly want to identify as being American, and American oftentimes just means wanting to identify with European American culture and European American ideology. And so...
Which means buy things.
So for me, like, when I think of the Latino community, of which I am a part of, there is a fear of mine, since people are saying, you know, that in the future that white people are going to be the minority in America. But again, that assumes that whiteness is static and that it can't evolve, or that it hasn't evolved to be more inclusive in order to continue its domination over Black, brown, and indigenous people.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I don't really know because I'm fucking white, but I know that I fucking see like Jewish people being like, I'm white passing. And I'm like, right. Yeah, that might be true, but you're still fucking white. I don't know. It's like kind of like, it's very weird. But this fucking holiday season, let me talk about this fucking Hanukkah gingerbread house. So this fucking Hanukkah gingerbread house. So basically I don't believe that Hanukkah would be a big holiday, because it's about fucking candles. It's about candles, like, not burning out. Fucking Passover is about slavery. Passover is being freed from slavery. Like, I think that would be the big holiday. Or the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah, or Yom Kippur. Like, the only reason why anybody gives a fuck about Hanukkah is because Christmas. So this fucking Hanukkah gingerbread house really solidified that idea for me. And I felt very angry when I saw it. And somebody told me they used it at work. Somebody at work who's like a Christian and they're from the South. And they're very nice. But they were like, oh, I got this Hanukkah gingerbread house. I was like, oh my God, that shit makes me so angry. And they were like, well, it's fun. I'm like, you would think it was fun, wouldn't you? You would think it was fun. But I had to instead be like, oh, I'm glad you had fun. That's great. But I was thinking to myself, yeah, exactly. Exactly. They didn't make that for Jews like me. They made it for you. So you guys could feel better about including us in your holiday.
What would feel more inclusive to you?
What would feel more inclusive? Having one fucking goddamn movie that's a Hanukkah movie, Well, here's the thing: like, we have like Passover movies, and we have shit that's like about the history of Hanukkah and shit. But like, we don't have any like Deck the Halls type shit. We don't have any like the Santa Claus movie. We don't even have a Santa Claus. We got Hanukkah Harry. Apparently, like, that's what they say. Oh, Hanukkah Harry comes and he lights the candle. It's like, you know, the fucking, like... Anyway, we're not here for me to talk about Judaism and all that shit. That was just part of my opening rant, but I realized I was stumbling on what the fuck I was talking about when I talked about, like, the concept of whiteness and who gets to be white and, like, who wasn't white and all this shit and holidays. But, yeah, we'll talk about the holidays more when we get to talking about some of the political topics we're getting into here, because I had some experiences with some teenagers. Oh my God, Idiocracy, it is real, everybody. If you've seen that movie, you should watch that movie, because it's the future of the United States. Maybe the world. Okay, so Sergio, tell me about this play. You wrote this play called Radical, and it played it under St. Mark's, right?
Yes, it played it under St. Mark's.
It's a great theater.
Yeah, we went to North Carolina with it. We went to the NAACP conference and did a stage reading of the play. Reverend William Barber was there, and I actually had the pleasure of meeting him. And we did a stage reading of the play. To, you know, an all-black, you know, audience. And people really liked it as a play, but had conflicting views on it in terms of its content. And after the play, I was dressed in my kind of Antifa outfit and made a speech kind of in defense of Antifa and advocating not only anarchism, but revolutionary struggle and about the limitations of civil disobedience. And essentially, that is what the play is. The play is a story about a woman named Celia Frank, who is a former radical political activist turned kind of house mom / feminist blogger. And the opening of the play is her in an interrogation room being interrogated by a detective. And at the same time, it's almost cinematic. At the same time, what's happening is you see a character named Hector Cienfuegos, whom I portrayed, being tortured in a prison. And he is a radical left-wing political activist, Antifa or anarchist, if you will. And what you realize is that these two people know each other and that they're former comrades. And what the NYPD wants Celia to do is they actually... Because the NYPD in this play finds out that the IRPGF, or the International Revolutionary People's Guerrilla Forces, have developed an American wing. and are planning to stage
But for people who don't know what that is, please explain what that is.
The International Revolutionary People's Guerrilla Forces is a faction in Rojava. They're a part of the International Freedom Battalion in historical Kurdistan that is actually helping the Kurdish revolution there, that is very much based in Abdullah Öcalan's ideals and Murray Bookchin's ideals, and are they don't call themselves anarchists. What they practice is democratic confederalism, and they practice also social ecology, and it's actually considered the most feminist revolution in the history of the world.
So democratic federalism?
Confederalism.
And what does that mean?
Democratic confederalism is an anti-statist idea where communities themselves run themselves through grassroots democracy and direct action and mutual aid. And basically...
So yeah, pretty much anarchist is by a different name.
Anarchism by a different name.
I've been trying to call myself an anarcho-conservative so I could just call myself a small-scale voluntary communist and really fucking like drive the libertarians insane. So that's like, you know, I say I'm a communist libertarian. They're like, what the fuck? And they lose their shit. But anyway, so they're concerned... The MIPD has discovered that they're... What is this called?
IRPGF.
IRPGF. Yeah. Okay, was that IRPGF? Because I'm familiar with a lot of, like, Rojava-type stuff. Mm-hmm. And, like, Rojava is, like, the place that they're claiming as their own, right? Kurdistan.
Yeah, the IRPGF is distinctly the anarchist, you know, wing of the International Freedom Battalion. These are the international volunteers who are going to Rojava to fight with the YPG and the YPJ.
Wait, I'm sorry. I just got confused. So the IRPGF, are the people coming from other places or...
They are part of them, yeah. They're distinctly anarchist.
Oh, so there's one faction of a larger group that is anarchist.
Yeah, I mean, like, some of them are Marxists, some of them are communists, and, you know, some of them, you know, they differ in ideology, but they all share and are standing behind the YPG and the YPJ, but they have their own ideologies and ideas about where the revolution should go. But it's so much based on community self-determination.
So democratic confederalism is what the IRPGF believes, and the YPJ and the YPG might not necessarily agree with that.
Not necessarily, and because there's so much diversity amongst the communities in what they believe, because it is all based on consensus among those communities. Some practice libertarian socialism, some practice kind of a free market, but essentially it's an anti-statist idea.
So pretty much everybody's anti-statist who's fighting that revolution.
Pretty much.
Okay, so that's okay, because I was, for a minute I was like, wait, is it not really as like anarchistic as all these fucking like kids on Twitter think it is? Okay, cool.
But in this play, the IRPGF has developed an American wing within the resistance movement in the age of American fascism, and are planning to stay. And the NYPD finds out that they're planning to stage a terrorist attack, quote unquote, in the United States or in New York City, and they want Celia Frank, the main character, to be an informant. And so she has to tell all of this to her husband, who knows nothing about this, who's basically kind of like a bourgeois, white, liberal...
Normie.
Yeah. But the thing is, one of the reasons I wrote that character into that play was because I wanted the audience to have an entrance into that world, which is something a lot of people don't know about or ignore or just simply are completely ignorant of. And so that was my way of getting, like, you know...
So they had an ally.
They had an in, so to speak. But what Celia Frank does is that she actually ends up meeting Hector in this kind of old warehouse where they used to live in a collective. But the collective has basically been disbanded, and this warehouse is abandoned. And Hector confirms what the NYPD is saying, and what the play becomes, and was always. My kind of intention was to have a conversation about when violence becomes a legitimate form of political resistance. And when does that become blessed? When does that become blessed by the masses?
What is the action they're planning?
They're planning to bomb the storage facility of a private military company in New York City. Something, for example, like Blackwater. Because mercenaries have become such an integral part of the militarized police force. And so they feel that it's their first act in their declaration of war against the United States government.
Do you think that, I mean, would they be hurting anybody doing this? Or would they be...
In the play, Hector says, you know, we've taken like actions to make sure that this operation is not going to kill anybody. And Celia responds to that and says, you can't guarantee that. And he says, no, I can't. Their intention is not to kill anybody. It's more to like dismantle these operations that this private military company is conducting. But he can't guarantee that no one will get killed. But the intention is not to kill someone, but to disrupt, to sabotage, and to use old anarchist terminology.
So do you think, so what do you personally think of an action like that?
Well, it's what the conversation of the play it really is about. I mean, it's Shavian in that sense, where it's very much a debate play. But where I personally lie is, if we're indeed living right now in an age of American fascism, I don't think violence should be taken off the table as a way to resist not only the state, but this kind of this alt-right or Nazi movement that is happening out in the streets, and that oppressed and marginalized communities need to be protected. And if that means resorting to violence in order to do that, I think it is a form of self-defense to protect ourselves from these reactionary forces.
And that's something that I would like to be putting into the conversation, is like, we got to stop calling it violence. Because I think, I mean, I don't necessarily know how I feel about the idea of like bombing, but when I think about, that's a whole other thing, but when I think about like, oh, being in an action and punching a Nazi, or like fucking sabotaging their meeting spaces, or making it very, very difficult for them to organize, I think of that as just not even just self-defense. I think of it as like a macro self-defense, like a larger scale self-defense. So I think we have to just start calling it self-defense and not violence, because I think violence is like an unprovoked concept.
Right. And the difference between something like the anarchist left and Nazis, that Nazis are actually advocating genocidal ideologies against oppressed and marginalized people, while Antifa are opposing that. And so to equate the two is not only ludicrous, but it really is about defending ourselves against these reactionary forces. And what makes it difficult now, I think, or even more difficult, is that this movement is so blatantly out in the open, and this movement sees itself in the White House. It sees itself like very much legitimized by the state, and the state has always been a problem for anarchists just in general. We've always faced state violence, but now we're having a grassroots, not really a corporatized movement, that are advocating these just radical statist, radical right-wing ideologies.
But a lot of them would consider themselves not to be statist, and that's the funniest thing about all of it. So you have, I have been studying these people for a little bit.
Okay.
I'm very obsessed with the alt-right, mm-hmm. but not, you know, in a good way. I'm obsessed with, like, trying to figure out the different facts. Like, for example, like the Proud Boys. Gavin McGinnis has actually said he disowns the rest of the alt-right, but his followers still like the alt-right, I'm sure many of them. But the Proud Boys themselves consider themselves to be an anti-government movement, which is so funny. Like, what I think a lot of them actually want is they like love Steve Bannon, because Steve Bannon considers himself to be an anarcho-capitalist, actually. Like, what I think they want to do is they want to marry business and the government so that the government is business. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, that's sort of what they want. They don't actually agree with what classically would be called the state. They identify the state as like a very like right-wing libertarian way of talking about the state, where they just view the state as this thing that disrupts the market and everything else they like about it. Do you know what I'm saying? It's sure. Very weird. They want this. They actually don't not want a state. They want the state to support their businesses. It's very weird. Like, they don't want a state, but they do. These fucking people in their free market. Like, none of them actually want a free market. They just want no regulation on their market. That's not a free market, because nothing's free in their market.
Well, Mussolini defined fascism as the merger of state and corporate power. So, I mean, I'm not sure how that distinguishes them from, you know, traditional or classical fascists.
It doesn't. It doesn't. I just think it's important to know that they don't think that they're for the state. It's funny. It's like funny how they Like, so what do you think the state is? That's an important question, I think. A lot of people talk about, like, the state this, the state that. A lot of people don't have, like, an actual like clear definition of what that is. What's your definition of the state?
Well, to me, the state is a nation that has a government, a federal government and state government that imposes rules on people into what they think the population should be. And to me, that is very antithetical to what a freedom and liberation is for people. And in terms of reinforcing, so to speak, it's like a series of laws and institutions that reinforce hierarchy and power. Mm-hmm. And that power is concentrated into the hands of very few people. And that is like the federal government and these corporatists as well that basically are all engage with one another in a very intimate way in terms of their business and economic interests on a global scale. And so this idea that this nation, the state, can impose these kind of this kind of society and basically dictate to people what they want, whether it's overt or whether it's systemic.
Exactly. I think we need to I think that like anarchism has like just about the worst PR in the world. Like just about the worst Maybe. PR in the world. And that's why I made that question. The question of today's episode actually is, can art and theater help people better understand Antifa? Because a lot of people don't fucking understand. They don't fucking get it. The history of protest is not taught in school. In fact, I think that should be an entire class personally, just because, and I don't necessarily think that everybody has to be an activist, although I wish, but what I do think is like, people should know that when you live in the world, if you don't like something or you think something is wrong and unjust, you can fucking speak out about it. And here's how it has worked in the past. Like Stonewall was a riot. People don't know mm-hmm. that.
Absolutely.
But they do know that, but they don't realize that it catapulted like the rest of the fucking LGBT rights movement. Like that is seen as a fucking turning point. If you don't know what that is, that's when a bunch of police came into gay bars in the West Village and Stonewall, the famous one, which is now a landmark. Everybody finally rebelled and they fucking threw a brick. Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson, look them up. Don't watch that fucking documentary on Netflix though, because that fucking guy stole this young trans woman's idea. Look at her documentary. She'll probably release. And yeah, anyway, we were talking about. So I think we need to call the state something different than we call it, because I don't think anybody I know is saying that we shouldn't have a centralized water source or right. something like
right.
that.
Right.
Nobody's fucking saying that. And I think nobody's saying that we shouldn't, you know, manage our infrastructure so that we don't have fires and shit like that. Right. Nobody's saying that when we say we don't like the state, but the people will hear that as something that the state does.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something we have to start talking about how we would be organizing. I just think we need a lot of different words. Because I think at this point, a lot of these words, I was talking to Natasha Leonard, who was on here a couple of weeks ago. You can go on Podomatic, what was it, theworld.podomatic.com to listen to that episode. And I was talking about how, like, you say fascism, people's eyes gloss over. You say feminism, people's eyes gloss over. And she was like, but if people, I don't know how hard it is to understand. Fascism is fascism. And I'm like, you're right. It is just but people don't listen to it. How do we get people to listen to these ideas without using like buzzwords or words that they don't or words that they will see as buzzwords?
I was having a conversation with a comrade of mine quite recently about changing how we can change the rhetoric in which we use, because the idea of the international working class or the proletariat and all these things really don't mean much to Americans in general, because Americans basically just see themselves as middle class, no matter almost in what economic sphere they're in, aside from the very wealthy who just know that they're very wealthy. And so changing that kind of rhetoric, because and I think even Maury Bookchin talked about that, where this idea of the working Maury Bookchin, who was a prominent anarchist philosopher, and he talked about the ideas of, you know, the working class actually not having necessarily the potential on an international level to unite, but that it could be done through communities, and not talking about necessarily communism, but redefining it as communalism and trying to bring it down to smaller scales. Because if we think about things in smaller scales and communities, in that way, we're actually, people are able to live their politics from every day and day to day, and not necessarily think about things in global ways, because that is just, it really oftentimes is too much for one individual to take in all the issues of the world. So if they can actually make an effective change within their own community, on their own block, like say, like for example, in Rojava, they have like
is it Rojava or Rojava?
I've heard Rojava, but people pronounce it Rojava as well.
I think people say Rojava. I always think of like someone who like mispronounces a word to sound cool. You know what I'm saying? Like Rojava.
Right.
I know, I always thought it was Rojava, but maybe you're right. I don't know. Anyway.
Well,
we should have asked Ulik of the last show, because he's Turkish. He probably would know how to.
He might not. But in Rojava or Rojava, they have a council almost on every block. You know, I mean, and they're operating in that way, and they're operating in a very organized manner on very low community scales, as opposed to thinking about, you know, a federal government.
Yeah, that's what I always say to people. People are like, you like communism? That will never work on a large scale. I'm like, does anything really work on a large scale? They're like, capitalism. I'm like, for you is working. Capitalism, something I said once at an open mic and people didn't like it. I said that communism is where, or by large scale communism is where you see all the pain and the hardship right in front of you. Capitalism is where you just push it to the next country. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like people are like, we live in a great world. America is blah, blah, blah. And apparently with capitalism, though, it has, somebody told me that capitalism has made it world hunger, has like helped with world hunger on a percentile, whatever, whatever. But that doesn't matter if people are less starving. It, you know, it's like so funny. It's like, we're going to pay you like 20 cents a day to make this t-shirt in slave labor, but we're going to feed you. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right,
it's like
right.
Fucking great. I was like, okay. Like, it's so funny.
That was one of my... Kind of like confusion about the recent Alabama elections. Like, your great victory is that the child molester wasn't elected into office. Like,
I know, right?
That's your great victory.
Oh God,
I don't quite get it.
And it's so funny. Like, I'm gonna talk about the holidays for a second. So there was this kid. We were talking about Antifa. I was like, listen, everybody. Like, the police aren't doing shit about the white supremacists. The government not doing anything. The media is making the only people who are doing anything about it look bad. Antifa, who's like, honestly, like, there's not that many people in Antifa. Honestly, Antifa, like, it's so funny people talk about Antifa like it's a like a monolithic group. Like, it's just a it's a bunch of punk kids, and that honestly should scare you, that the bunch of punk kids are the only people doing anything about it. Like, I'm not gonna claim that a bunch of punk anarchist kids know how to organize. There are a bunch of anarchists that do. I'm not saying there aren't factions of Antifa that organize very well. I'm sure there are. What I'm saying is, though, a lot of them are disorganized little punk kids who are trying to figure out how to survive and create a world that has less hierarchy and less oppression, but they're young. A lot of kids, people in Antifa are young, and I'm like, not to be ageist or whatever, but you know what I'm saying, right? Like, yeah. It's like, that should terrify you, that the only people who are even concerned to do anything about it are, I would guess that the ages of Antifa range from 18 to mid-30s. I would guess that the high percentages are in their mid to young 20s.
Yeah.
And that should scare the fucking living shit out of you, that they're the only people who are taking a stand against that kind of thing. That should also comfort you, that the next generation doesn't want to deal with Nazis as much as the rest of the generations who just hushed it and pretended like white supremacists weren't out there.
Sure. I mean, this has been a movement that's been going for like 30, 40 years.
I mean, Antifa's been going for way longer than that. But.
No. But I mean the white supremacist movement in this country.
Oh, white supremacists. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, the, if you follow
been
like what
hiding
the Southern,
in the woods.
Yeah. Like, the Southern Poverty Law Center has been covering this for a very long time. I mean, I was raised by two communists who were, you know, very, you know, socially conscious. And my mother subscribed to the Southern Poverty Law Center, and she would get their magazines, and there was always this growing threat of white supremacists just kind of lurking in the shadows and kind of waiting for a very charismatic figure, and they found one. But going back to your point, though, about anarchists having very bad PR, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to write this play, was because I wanted to give Antifa like a voice, and a very much a human voice that is not often heard, because we're often heard out in protest singing or chanting the most provocative, chants. But there's also a side to us that is like that genuinely believes in the goodness of humanity and believes in solidarity and believes in love for our fellow, comrades and for our fellow people and for oppressed and marginalized people, and want to see an end to hierarchy because we see that as an evil structure. And in this play, what I had, Hector Cienfuegos and Celia Frank, one of the things where they connect, one of the things thinks where they connect is that they're both lovers of poetry, that they actually quote Yeats and Blake and Byron and Bobby Sands, you just name a couple of Irishmen, to one another. And that's actually one way they connect. And their conversation regarding when violence becomes legitimized, or when civil disobedience ends and violent resistance begins, it is one that is based on the goodness of society. Like, what do we do in order to change the current situation? Because if we're indeed living in where American fascism has reached its fullest form, soon there will come a day that where you're not going to ask the question whether violence is legitimized or not, or legitimate or not. You're going to ask, which side are you on? And to me, that's what I wanted to do in this play. And this play was really much about provoking a conversation, because in plays, I've been criticized in the past for some of my plays. I had one play called I Want to Kill Lena Dunham. That premiered at the New York Fringe Festival in 2015.
Did people lose their shit over that title?
Some did, yeah. We got mixed reviews, which was quite interesting. But one review that one criticism I got of that was that I felt was very legitimate, was that it was something very didactic. I forgot how you phrased it. He said the playwright tells you what the problem is, so there's very little room for audience interpretation. And so for Radical, what I wanted to do is I wanted to leave it open-ended. I wanted to have the conversation started and have the audience make up their own minds.
That's very interesting, because now I'm on this question now. I said, do you think like bombing something creates another state and also reinforces hierarchy?
Can you be
so you made this point before about the state being like a group of people that's almost like what I would usually call democratic, because that would be like democratic would usually mean like a group of people who decides what's best for the greater good. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying, like, do you think like that concept of like bombing something, and it's okay, it might hurt people, but it's good for the cause? Do you know what I'm saying? Do you think that like sort of reinforces another hierarchy? Maybe not bombing like a private like arms thing. Although when I think about that, possibly that could trigger other bombs to go off maybe. And then a lot of people would die. So think about that. But do you know what I'm saying? Like, and I think I might be in danger of doing that equating thing that people do. But like, for example, like killing Nazis is different because their entire ideology. I would totally love to kill a Nazi. Let's not even fuck around. But like, I think what's more important is to make it very difficult for them to organize and then set up a bunch of white supremacist rehabilitation centers like all over the place, like on every corner. Do you know what I mean? Once we make it clear that it's not okay to organize and make it very clear to them that this is not acceptable, some of them, not all of them, the ones that, you know, we kill the ones who can't do it. But the other ones go, hey, maybe I should, maybe this is fucked up. Maybe I need help. And then, you know what I'm saying? If rehabilitation centers are in every corner, maybe they'll go. Because people have been rehabilitated.
I think that's optimistic.
Maybe it is. But what I'm saying is, the defense people give me all the time when I talk about punching Nazis is they say, like, well, there have been people who have been rehabilitated. And I said, that's true. There have been people who have been rehabilitated from being white supremacists. That doesn't mean it's going to happen, which is why we make it hard for them to organize first. Do you know what I'm saying? We make them scared. We make them very scared to organize, so then they can't fucking organize.
Well, I can address probably the second point better, because I remember I was in a bar with a comrade of mine after a MAC meeting, which we both were very disappointed when we went to. We were in a bar and this woman came up to us and kind of told us this story where she was on a bus and there was a white supremacist who had been reformed, and he like shared his story with her. And we were, both identify as Latino, and we kind of both said to her, we don't really care if you've been reformed or not, because we don't know what that person's damage was when he was a white supremacist and what he organized and how many black, brown, and indigenous people he may have hurt, whether it was through physical action or whether it was pushing legislation or whether it was in any various kinds of ways. Because, I mean, we're inherently living in a white supremacist and white supremacist society that is enforced through white domination over all other people. discuss white male supremacy ideas. So for me, I'm not really interested in having a conversation with Nazis or white supremacists. I'm interested in, you know, making sure that they feel very afraid to go out into the streets and organize. Yeah, that's my takeaway from that. So
I think you're right. I think you're right in that sense. But I also think that, first of all, I don't think it would be your job to rehabilitate them personally. Or like,
no.
Yeah, it wouldn't be your job. But what saying is like,
it shouldn't be.
But the only thing is, so right now, you know, we talk about how it was like, you know, the Southern Poverty Law has been covering them for a long time. Mm-hmm. But in a sense, even though it was there, they were more in hiding, right?
Yeah.
And they were still hurting people.
Yes.
So what I'm saying is, how do we stop it from bubbling up to the surface again? How do we stop people from doing this in their backyard? How do we prevent this idea from spreading onto their children? So what I'm saying is, if we're not just going to straight up kill all of them, how the fuck, you know what I'm saying? There has to be another, like, you don't have to ever want to talk to a rehabilitated white supremacist ever. But yeah. What's also been discovered, which was on Democracy Now, somebody told me about this, is that it's been seen that a lot of these men have undiagnosed Asperger's or undiagnosed autism.
Oh, is that right?
And they're comforted by like singular thinking. So that, and I'm saying that doesn't excuse anything they're doing, just like I have PTSD and doesn't excuse me from being an asshole about my PTSD. But you know what I'm saying? Like, it is complex. It is complex. Like, a white supremacist is a white supremacist. Fucking cut it the fuck out. You're not allowed to do that. You're a fucking, you know what I mean? But it is interesting question, like, what do we do about that later? So what I was saying before is, like, I didn't want to equate, like, when I, like, you know, when, like, military arms are obviously, like, dangerous and shit, or fucked up. So it's, like, I'm trying to talk about, like, when I said, like, is bombing somebody or you not, if you bomb white supremacists, that's different. But I'm saying if you bomb something in order for, like, the greater good, what makes it the greater good? Do you know what I'm saying? Does that just become the state or a state?
I don't know if it becomes a state. I mean, it's an excellent question. I don't know if I'm exactly in a position to answer it in a satisfying way. But all I can tell you is that I think, and what I was trying to accomplish with this play was to ask that question, when does that start? Like, at what point do you start doing organizing in that manner, organizing in a militant manner? I mean, because at some point there has to be a line. I mean, to quote Noam Chomsky very, like, loosely, like, you know, like, if you try to practice civil disobedience in a concentration camp, well, it's too late, to take a dramatic example. So at what point before we get there do we start rebelling in a militant way? And I don't think there's a simple answer to that question, especially in America. You know, because we have so many, we don't just have such a reactionary government. We have a very reactionary population that, I mean, we have the majority of our population will vote against its own interests, for example, out of their hatred for immigrants, gays, and black people.
Or because of fucking religion.
And also whiteness. I mean, like, let's not pretend that Donald Trump got in there because of the white working class. I mean, it was the white ruling class. It was my upper middle class, the working class, the, you know, the,
people voted for women.
I mean, like, yeah, but the thing they all had in common was not economic anxiety, but was whiteness. And so when we're talking about white supremacists and like re-education programs, it's like, well, we have to take into consideration that white supremacy is a spectrum. And that, yes, there are Nazis, but there are also white supremacists that don't know that they're white supremacists and wouldn't consider themselves racist.
Oh, yeah. I hear people fucking say like weird little alt-right things all the time who are like, I'm pretty liberal. I'm like, okay, well, first of all, what you don't realize is that republicanism or like conservatism and liberalism both came from so-called classic liberalism, which are the same fucking thing. It's
yeah.
Global market. So they don't realize that, but it's so funny. They're like, oh, I'm a leftist, but like, don't you think that like these identity politics are da 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 da, and like, I don't know, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
The people who start talking about like white identity politics are fucking hilarious.
But that's what I think what Trump's election was about. I think it was about white identity politics, and that was where he was able to capitalize on that. On people feeling as though they're disenfranchised, when in reality it's like you actually are at the top of the food chain, but you don't see yourself that way. You see yourself as a victim, and I don't want to undermine like, you know, working class people's, you know, grievances. I mean, people have legitimate grievances, like if they can't pay the mortgage on their home, or if they lose their job, if they have anxiety about their kids going to school and paying for college. Like, these are all, like, you know, those are legitimate grievances. But the problem with where I kind of have a problem with is, like I will stand with you in terms as a working class, as a fellow working class person, working class artist. But if you're going to call me a spick while we're doing it, then I'm sorry, we can't have solidarity in that way. And that's your problem, because if you need to call me a spick or a wetback or anything like that, that's actually your problem, and you have to figure out why you need that. And this is why I've always been very critical of white leftists who kind of see themselves as absolving themselves of responsibility when it comes to the issue of race. Because I really do think it is the responsibility of white people to dismantle white supremacy and dismantle the institutions in which they benefit. Because it's something they created, it's something they still receive privileges from, and it at the expense of Black, brown, indigenous people, and in particular, Black people. So it's really their responsibility to dismantle it. You can't ask people of color to dismantle something like that, because we're too busy surviving those things.
I just have a very interesting comment. Oh, sorry, I don't want to draw attention from what you just said. Yes. I feel like that is definitely like a thing. I miss some of what you said because of fucking people, like people who are listening saying things. But I do sense that a lot. Like, what I've noticed is that in a lot of activist groups, there's this sense of like where like sort of the culture from the outside comes into the culture on the inside. For example, I've been to like Black Lives Matter protests where like some white dude is screaming the entire thing and nobody else, not even the people who like organized the march, are doing the kind of crap he's doing. And they're like, what the fuck are you doing? People are like looking at him like, what's going on? And he like is like, it's for the cause. He doesn't realize he's like dominating the message. It's like kind of funny. Everybody does it. I do it. I don't do that exactly, but I do other things. And I'm sure there are things I'm not even aware of. But and you should look at yourself. Last night I got really fucking drunk at this open mic, and I was telling people, I was like, want to know why Trump got elected? Because of you and me and you. And people were just like, what the fuck? I was like wasted as fuck. And I was like, I hated 2012 when I meant to say 2017. Oh, that fucking hilarious. But okay, so I have all these things that I tweeted on Twitter. We're gonna play some kind of song. I don't know what song we're gonna play yet. But I tweeted all these things that you can answer the questions. I wrote, does anarchism have the worst PR ever? You can find it by looking at the hashtag what would save the world. I said, do you think the way we talk about anarchist theory is elite? And I wrote, I fucking tweeted this twice, but whatever. I wrote, where is the line between militant and civil when it comes to activism? I think that's a very important question. I think that's sort of what your play is tackling, like you said. I think it's a very good question. So let's play a song, and then let's talk about the future of your show after that. Or you're talking about possibly making it into a movie, is that what you were saying?
Yes.
Okay, I gotta find a song right now. What songs do you like? What song do you think we should play?
I don't know. Blue Scholars.
Blue Scholars.
Yeah,
all right, let's do this. Let's play a song. Let's play Sagaba.
Sister sits on the steps, cigarette rests on fingertips, takes a sip of slow death, deftly through her lips, she blows a kiss, which I can only resist in vain. She got the gift of gravity, pulling to ask her name, she says Sagaba. What's it mean? She says in Ilocano, it translates into suffering. I'm pondering the irony to conjure up the fearlessness to find a conversation. She offers me a square, I decline the invitation. It reminds me of the days when I would chain smoke, broken with no hope, like broken like the manner she spoke. We both, two people seeking solace and remembrance, and wondering if miracles were meant for us, but intent was just just an innocent thought between a sister and the brother who've been building in the guidance of a mother. And the storyteller stops, waiting for the beat to drop, gathering his thoughts in the wind, breathing in like... Gathering his thoughts in the cloud, breathing out like... Gathering his thoughts near the edge of the daylight.
Is it sexist when I'm confused why pretty women become cops? Well, it's not over yet. Everybody, so something I just thought of is we should fucking have a cops who turn anarchist calendar. Like, you know, we have the fucking firefighter calendar. We should have cops who turn anarchist calendar. Like, that would be a sexy fucking calendar, honestly. So we were talking about how, like, cops sometimes you're like confused. It's like, oh, you're cute. Why do you have to be a fucking cop, idiot? But it's because Sergio was telling me that one of his actors went pretty red or went pretty left, and like they fucking they played the cop, and I was like, that's hot. So that's where we got this idea. So does anarchism have the worst PR ever? Somebody said, because it's by nature disorganized. That's not how that fucking works. Again, but maybe we should just democratic confederalism. Fine. I'm an anarchist through and through, but we got to stop using that word because nobody knows what the fuck it means. They're like, chaos? I'm like, that's the science word. They're like, no, I'm pretty sure that's a political one too. LOL. Laffy face, XDXD. Do you know what I'm saying? And then somebody said, nope, that'd be libertarianism. All right, Arena, I can say your name as you've been on this show before. I love you. I think you're amazing. But that's such fucking bullshit, okay? Donald Trump is basically like some sort of like weird ass pseudo-libertarian, which is what they all are. If you actually want to talk about what libertarian actually is, libertarianism doesn't mean what it means anywhere else but this country. All right, they took a great word and they made it stupid. They dumbed it down, like America. God, like the United States. The fact that I even call it America is dumb. Do you know what I mean? I read that if you go to Mexico, people are like, why are you fucking saying you're from America? This is America too. In fact, your country should be my country because my fucking ancestors farmed that land that you're using, idiot. And my relatives now farm that land, but now they're not because you're president, so nobody's fucking farming that land right now, idiot. God. Anyway, so we got about 10 minutes left. I hope I didn't go on a rant too much. So tell me, what is happening with this show now? Are people going to be able to go see it? You're going to try to make a film? What's the scenario? Should you make a web series? I don't know.
I don't plan on making a web series, but what I would ideally like was, like, I would like to have another theatrical production of it so we can have another run. But as of right now, I'm actually in talks to make it into a feature film. I have a couple of producers who are already interested, and I have an actor in Los Angeles. Her name is Jessica Renee Russell, who is actually kind of climbing the ladder in terms of exposure.
Ooh.
We were in a feature film together about 5 years ago, a film called Hole in the Wall, which is about a Mexican immigrant chef. I played the Mexican immigrant chef, now on iTunes. Sorry, little plug of mine.
You can plug whatever the fuck you want on this show.
The film is called Hole in the Wall. I would recommend it. It's it's on iTunes. You can rent it for $5. It's great for the holidays. It's a family film. And it's a very pro-immigrant film in that sense. But we made this film about 5 years ago together. We've been wanting to work with each other since. And I showed her the play. I sent her the play, and she loved it and wants to play the main character. And she's kind of really on the rise. And so she actually might be able to help us get funding for the film. And I'm going to be going to, like, the NAACP and other organizations to try and help raise money for the film as well. So if we can raise, because I think we really can do the film for about $20,000 or $30,000, which is a very low budget film.
You could probably do it for less, honestly, these days. Like, what do you even need? You need a warehouse?
We need a warehouse. We need, like, a torture chamber. We need to abide by SAG-AFTRA rules and
stuff. What's that mean?
SAG is the union for
paying.
Screen. Yeah, like paying actors.
For the actors.
Yeah, and paying the crew and things like that. So, I mean,
I would never work with a SAG actor at this point. Unless their financial core, because it's like SAG's mad exploitative in its own way. Like, you're not allowed to do non-union work. Like, it's one thing if, I don't know, that should be voluntary, in my opinion. Like, do you want to use union or not? Because, like, apparently, like, John Voight, fuck John Voight, though, but apparently, like, he wasn't allowed to go to the SAG Awards when he was nominated because he was financial core because he did a non-union film. It's ridiculous. It's culty.
Oh, no. I mean, SAG after definitely has its issues.
But anyway, your budget.
Getting the budget is right now is kind of the next step. This very much could be a film coming to you soon-ish, maybe like in a year, maybe a year and a half.
Hell yeah.
So that's the future I want to see, because we had such limited exposure when you do a play, like in New York, for example, especially under St. Mark's, like a 40-seat, house.
It's a great theater, though.
It's a great theater. But when we do it on a film, particularly with the internet and the digital revolution, we're able to spread it out much more. And I think we can actually capture the essence of what we were trying to capture in the play into a film. And that's, I think, what the next step is going to be for this project.
So do you think that... using theater and art, this was the question we advertised this with, is a way to get people to start thinking about this, for people to, like, see people, like, in a fictionalized story talking about these issues rather than, like, on Facebook in real life. Like, what effect do you think that has? Like, do you think that your play has changed people's minds? Have you talked to anybody whose minds have been changed other than the actors?
Yeah, I have. I mean, the audience members were always, captivated by the play. And if they didn't have their minds changed, they certainly started to ask the question that I wanted them to ask. It's like, well, where, like, if you're, so you believe in nonviolence. Okay, well, where does that end? And it's a question that they don't often consider. And to me, and I posed this on one podcast where the guy who was hosting it got very mad at me.
Was he a white dude?
White Latino.
I'm racist.
but he was saying that he really believed in nonviolence. He's a big fan of nonviolence. He loves turning the other cheek, that kind of thing.
I'm not into pacifism, but I do like no violence, but yeah. like sometimes you have to.
But what I said though is like to say that violence is never an option, no matter what the circumstances, I think is immoral. I think that that is in like in an immoral stance, because I do think that there's sometimes where you do have to rise up and take a stand. And if that means defending yourself the way Malcolm X told us we should, you know, so be it. Because, I mean, if we have to achieve liberation by any means necessary, that really does mean by any means necessary. And, you know, it's like what happened with the letter the Egyptian revolutionary sent to Occupy Wall Street. They said, you know, if the state had given up immediately, we would have been overjoyed. But as they sought to kill us, imprison us, and torture us, we knew that there was no other way than to fight back. And so I believe violence is a last resort, but I also believe it's never not an option.
Oh my God. Yeah, so we have about 5 more minutes, but I agree with you. That's that reminds me, and you reminded me of, what's his name? Wa'il Ghonim, that name guy's name? He said the most interesting thing. He said on this, like, they were, like, talking to him about the people who died in, you know, the Arab Spring. And he was like, he cried and he said, "I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry." But he said in Arabic, but he said, "But do not blame me. Do not blame us. Blame all the people who held on to power and would not let go." And when I first, like, I read it in subtitles, I got fucking chills. I was like, that's like my entire generation. Like, that's what we're asking. We're saying, blame those who held on to power and would not let go. And that's what we're really seeing. A bubbling up of all the issues that people have been ignoring. Well, you haven't been ignoring it, and maybe I was for a little bit, but you know what I'm saying? Like, people were ignoring it, and it's all bubbling up to the surface. It really is. All the sins of our past, I hate to call it sins, but like, okay, you know what's really funny? All the people who believe in the rapture don't believe in global warming.
Isn't that funny?
Is that one of the funniest things ever?
Yeah.
I don't know. Hysterical. They're like, there is no global warming, but it's like okay, well, like, you are literally like the ones who are voting for the kinds of things that are gonna cause the rapture. I gotta call my grandmother and talk to her about this on my fucking southern side. I want to come out to her and then talk to her about the rapture and talk to her about global warming. I want to see if I can use her religion to bring her to the left.
Well, it might help.
Actually, I mean, the Catholic workers are awesome.
Well, yeah, and the liberation theology was very big in Latin America. And, you know, we had very progressive priests in the exactly. 1980s, in El Salvador especially.
But anyway, we have to come to an end here. And I want to ask you, do you have anything left you want to say? Do you want to pitch anything before? I mean, you want to promote anything before we go? We have like 2 minutes.
Yep. Just, I mean, again, check out Hole in the Wall on iTunes and hasta la victoria siempre.
And that's been Sergio Castillo. You should keep your eye out for Radical, the play Radical, or the film. You've been listening to What Would Save the World on Radio Free Brooklyn. My name is Tuke Edelo. I'm here every Wednesday from 3 to 4 p.m. Next week, I will be having Michelle Joni on here, who is a new agey. I hate to say that's kind of mean, but she is new agey, and we're going to have a big conversation debating new age tactics versus my tactics. It's going to be a very intense conversation, but she is very talented and very, very entertaining woman, so I'm excited to have her on. We disagree on a lot of things, but I do like her. Thank you so much. Actually, Tilly, her sister, was on a few weeks ago, and we talked about the fashion industry and how fucked up that is. But if you ever want to be on the show, you can email me at Tuke, T-O-O-K, at RadioFreeBrooklyn.com. I'm always looking for people. Radio Free Brooklyn, you can submit a show to us by going to RadioFreeBrooklyn.com, or you can listen to us more, or you can go to Podomatic.com, whatwouldsavetheworld.podomatic.com, to listen to my past episodes. Again, thank you so much, Sergio, for being here. Sergio Castillo, let's play out with some of your music. Also, you can follow me on Twitter at the number 2, like the symbol, K-E-D-A-L-O-W, or you can look up the hashtag whatwouldsavetheworld, and you can respond to this. Oh, somebody actually said something that I forgot to read. But anyway, whatever. We're gonna play. Are you taking my picture? Oh my God. Oh my God. Let's play some fucking. Let's play this out with some funny song right now. Here we go. This does not represent my views at all. This song. I think it's fucking funny to play this out. Actually, I could rant on this for a minute. I love how they're like, don't know what I want, but I know how to get it. It's like such a fucking funny comment that I think a lot of people don't catch. Okay, bye everybody. Thanks for listening.